old bird of 35, thinking inside the box. I grew up in the Garden of England in the 1950s. Autumn days were spent riding our bikes to the out-of-the-way orchards where we thought the farmer wouldn't catch us scrumping. Summer cherries were best if you could avoid being terrified by cherry cartridges going off and deafening you. By August, the apples were edible but left you with cheeks pulled in and a tummy ache. By mid-September, apples and pears dripped with juice whenever you bit into them, and the only danger was being stung by late and lazy wasps, who were scrumping too. I moved away from home as a late teenager, and after university worked in Scotland and Lancashire. My family emigrated, my in-laws moved to Norfolk, so I had no reason to go back to my childhood haunts. When I first came back home in the mid-1990s, I was, of course, shocked to see how small my old schoolyard was. That's normal, I suppose. I was shocked, too, to find that the village I spent most of my childhood in had gone upmarket. The high street had been newly cobbled, and that was not the end of its gentrification. The old newspaper shop around which we hunted as five-year-olds for old bus tickets, why on earth we collected the stiff cardboard tickets, I've no idea, was now called Guns and Saddles. The Colonnade General Store, where Mum bought broken biscuits for cheapness, had become the bridal shower. Most saddening of all was that Dolly's calf was now baguettes and brioche. Sadly, Dolly was no more. She may have succumbed to her liberal smoking. We never saw Dolly without a fag hanging from the corner of her mouth, threatening to shed its long grey ash onto the scones. Or she may have fallen foul of her own interpretation of health and safety. Which consisted of daily dusting of any unsold cakes and a minor price reduction, making them more attractive to us young layabouts. These changes are an age-old truism. As you grow up, the world around you seems to shrink. But the one thing you can surely rely upon... is that the saplings seen in youth growing to towering trees. Not a bit of it. The biggest shock of all was finding that all the apple trees had shrunk while I was away. There were no longer 20-foot-high feeding grounds for lesser-spotted woodpeckers, all set about with lush grass for the sheep to graze, then dug over in the autumn by pigs getting drunk on fermenting fruit. Nothing now dared grow above the reach of the apple picker. When I was at school, you would beset problems such as, a 6-foot-tall farmer has an orchard where all the trees are 20 feet high. His ladder extends to 20 feet. At what angle should he lean the ladder for stability and still reach the tops of the trees? The answer to this poser was decidedly not make the trees smaller. How about this one? The farmer's wife has 6 children. Every day she bakes a 1-pound loaf. She eats twice as much as the children, and her husband eats half as much again. How much does each child eat? Encouraged to think outside the box, the solution's obvious. The farmer should grow GM wheat designed to resist all disease and able to survive chemical assault. He should then spray his fields with pesticides and herbicides so that his yields are higher. At the end of each year, he should scour the land with acid to kill everything and plant the same crop year after year after year. This will mean he can have 4 more children, and their daily bread will be enough to feed them all twice as much as before, so that they can become obese. If at any stage the price of wheat rises to a level that actually pays the farmer to grow it, cheaper wheat will be imported, thus ensuring carbon footprint are much larger than the world can sustain. Now, as I sniff the autumn spiced air, I can see that at Thanet Earth, the largest area of greenhouses in the country, it is the season of mellow fruitfulness. The vines hang with tomatoes grown without the nuisance of soil. They are big and red and uniformly round, as appetizing to the eye as can be. Old farts like me, of course, can remember trotting off to the local nursery to buy a bag of blues, those non-conformist tomatoes that were over-large, dwarfed or misshapen with amusing appendages. And boy, did they taste good. It's no coincidence that the most popular tomato grown is called Moneymaker, and it is, to my mind, as tasty as over-boiled rice. Thinking outside the box and pushing the envelope into blue sky thinking has led us down a literal dead end. GM crops are, of course, completely safe. The government says so, and all the research sponsored by GM companies confirm it. It has been proven beyond doubt that rape seeds cannot disperse more than a field or two from their source. No one has told the bees, who can cross-pollinate as much as 12 kilometres away. Not to worry, though, we're now doing a great job of killing off the honeybees. The death of bees from the mite-carried virus seems to be linked with stress that lowers their natural resistance. How do you stress out bees? Are they easy to tease? No, instead of hives permanently being placed at intervals in food-producing areas, we now move the hives around to order, taking their pollinating proclivities from field to field over several months and across many miles, each time disorienting the bees and reducing the size of the swarm. It's time to stop moving the boxes and think inside them again. You do not solve out-of-control population growth by increasing yields any more than you do solve traffic problems by building more roads. I'll read that again. You do not solve out-of-control population growth by increasing yields any more than you solve traffic problems by building more roads. Anyway, several studies now show that GM crops yield are, on average, a few percent lower than existing varieties. You do not lower food prices by bankrupting farmers. Keeping finance in the first world, manufacturing in the second, and food production in the third world is just colonism. Oh, bum. Keeping finance in the first world, manufacturing in the second, and food production in the third world is just colonialism by the back door. Why did people use crop rotation for centuries? Because it worked. It's a low-tech, low-cost way of ensuring that pests and disease do not take hold. When Britain was struggling to stem the tide of Nazis from engulfing us, we dug for victory. Using far less of the land than we do now to grow crops, yet with sustainable production, that sustained a more boring yet better diet. Back in the box, we may have tried to tame nature around us, but we did not try to destroy it, as if it were the enemy, and we left the wild corners to themselves. Back in the day, we understood simple arithmetic. You reap what you sow, one for the rook, one for the crow, one to rot and one to grow. Great oaks from little acorns grow. Where the bee sucks, there suck I. You cannot thrive in trade if you expect to sell something for less than it costs. You cannot force a quart into a pint pot. 10 billion people into one earth doesn't go, and they cost the earth, and I really do mean that literally. That's the end of that one, Charlie. Over to you, Maddie.